One more advertisement. I've had a number of people who've come up to me and asked me, how can we learn more about Islam? Where are there any courses? There are no courses on Islam here in Britain except one, and that's our course. It's called Fander Course of Apologetics, and if any of you are interested in taking it, you don't have to come to us, we come to you. This is a Zoom webinar course, which means every Tuesday, starting on September the 17th, we are broadcasting in about 21 countries, over 100 students. This is our fourth year we've done this, and we're in over 21 countries now. And we come right to your laptop. So it comes to you. It goes from 5 to, I think it's 5 to 7 in the evenings here. I'm going to look, make sure I got the right time. In the UK, it is 60-minute long lectures. And it's 2 to 4 p.m. every Tuesday here. So wherever you are in the world, most of you will be here in the UK, you just designate your time. You don't have to watch it live, because once the lecture goes out, then it goes up online. And if you're registered, you get it then, and you can then pull it down and watch it at your leisure. But it's 90 minutes long, and I have three booklets here, so come and see them afterwards. If you're interested, we have a sign-up sheet here for the Fander course. If you want to take the Fander course, put your name, and then put your email so I can read it or Judy can read it. That is a big problem. If we don't read your email, it's not going to get to where it needs to go. And that doesn't register you. That just gets you, so then the office in London will then contact you, and they'll give you, you'll get this brochure as well in the mail. So you can decide. Every one of the titles for the courses are listed here, so you can see them. And the first, from September 17th to October 22nd, are all theological insights on Islam and Christianity, comparing the two. Then we go into the historical critiques. I have not even done any of that at this here at the conference. And that goes from the 5th of November to the 10th of December. Starting in the new year with Module 3, then we get into textual and theological critique, which is from the 14th of January to the 18th of February. And then from the 3rd of March to the 7th of April, we go through mission and social implications. Now, this is the only course that teaches you both apologetics and polemics anywhere in the world. This is not taught anywhere but here. And it's coming out of London, though I'm in America. The other three teachers are here in London. Dr. Paul Blackham, Beth Grove, who's soon going to be married, so she'll have a whole new name. It's finished. It's about this long, so I don't even know how to pronounce it yet. And then PJ. So the four of us are the ones that teach the course. I do all the historical material. It's the only place that you can get this kind of material, and it's all groundbreaking material. Some of this I'm going to be introducing next week in London at Kensington Temple. So it's exciting. It's new. We've been going on our fourth year. Do come and see us, talk to us, and look at the handout, and then over break time, and then sign up. Also, we have our prayer letter sign up on this side here. So if any of you want to get on our prayer letter sheet, come and sign your name, and again, write eligibly so I can see your email. And we'd love to have you on board. Then that will keep you up with where we're going, what I'm doing around the world, and all the new material you will get. I send it in PDF form to those of you who are on the sign-up. So that's my plug. Please do take a card, one of our cards here, because this also keeps you in contact with me. I have my email on it, and it has the Fander Films, the Fander Film URL on the back. Now, yesterday and the day before, I was talking about apologetics and polemics. I defined the term. Apologetics is to defend. Polemics is to go on the offense. It's much like your football team. You have your strikers and you have your defenders. And you need your defense to keep them from winning. So you need your apologetics. And we do pretty good at apologetics in Christianity, don't we? Most every school, most every Bible school, I did my first master's degree in apologetics. But the apologetics I was taught was not what I am now using today. The apologetics I was taught was really how to defend against the attacks by the humanists and the atheists, the Mormons to a lesser extent, some of the cults, but nothing on how to deal with Muslims. There's no school that teaches Islamic apologetics, which is tragic to me, because when you stop and think, they are the largest, fastest growing religion on earth. They will soon supersede Christianity as the largest religion in about 50 years. both Catholics and Protestants put together. They'll be larger than us. And they're the only religion that is attacking us on every corner, in every state, in every country, on every theological aspect. They are the ones that are attacking us more than any other. That's why, as I said yesterday, they had 43,000 videos attacking Christianity back in 2006. Now it's over hundreds of thousands that are up there. And yet we still are not engaging with them. We still have not taken them seriously. In all my seminary courses, all I was taught was how to deal with the Catholics. Well, that's 500 years ago. We have not retooled for the next big onslaught. And the onslaught is coming from Islam. To a lesser extent from the atheists, yes, they are there. But the biggest attack against the church right now that's happening, especially the church outside of Europe, especially the church in the Middle East and in Africa, is Islam. We've got to take it seriously. When I started working, and the reason Judy and I are even working in the Islamic world is because we went to a seminar back in 1981. And in 1981, at that seminar, we were told that there were 800 million Muslims in the world at that time. 800 million. Too big a number. How do you compute that number like that? Went in this year, out this year, I didn't really pay attention to it. The next two numbers, although, shocked me. I was told that the number of missionaries working amongst these 800 million was only 1,500. And that the 1,500 only made up 2% of all missionaries. Now, those two statistics I could compute. Those two statistics were like a slap in my face. I turned towards Judy and I said, what in the world are we doing wrong? Why are we only sending 2% of our entire missionary force to the fastest growing religion, the strongest religion in the world, the most aggressive religion in the world, and the religion that's no longer over there, it's now coming over here in a big way. And that's why we decided to dedicate ourselves to Islam. I had no love for Muslims. Remember, I grew up with Muslims. I did not like them. I had roommates that were Muslims. I was so glad to leave India in 1971 to get away from Islam. And I thought, never again did I want to engage with Muslims. And here in 1981, what, 10 years later, the Lord was putting these statistics in front of my eyes. Since 1981, we've been working with Muslims ever since. And since that time, it's gone from 800 million up to 1.8 billion. Please don't blame me for that. It has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with biological growth. Muslims are the fastest growing religion, not because of conversion, but because of the biology. They have the largest families, and you are born a Muslim. You do not accept it. It accepts you. And you do not leave it. You do not decline it, because that is a capital offense on pain of death. Not here in the UK. They're not killing them in the UK, nor in the West. But in any other Muslim country that I have to get into, those countries, it is a capital offense. So because of that, we have dedicated ourselves to working with Muslims, and we have found that there has been an enormous amount of attraction, especially since 9/11, and I think that's where Islam came into your view. That's where you all heard about Islam. You knew about it, but that's where really it came in, and it made an impact on you in 9/11, 2001. And for you here in Britain, the 7/7 number, which is July the 7th, 2005, when they attacked London. And those 52 people were killed in London. We were there. We saw the bodies coming out of one of the tubes as I was trying to get down to a meeting in central London. So these are something that have been emblazoned on our mind. And then, of course, when ISIS grew after Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and Tabligh Jamaat and Jamaat Islami and all these groups started growing all over the world, and they started coming on our TV screens, and we started seeing people being assassinated on our television scenes in orange coats, and this suddenly showed us that there was a real problem. But this problem, we'd always been told, was a very small problem. It was only a very infinitesimal small number of Muslims. They only made up possibly 1%. And that's what I've been told all my life, 1% of Islam. And I'd always wanted to know where they got this 1% from, because that's not the statistics we were coming across. Even here in Britain, back in 2001, after the 9/11, they did a survey amongst Muslims here in the United Kingdom. And they asked around 10,000 Muslims, do you support Al-Qaeda, this group that had attacked? This was after about a month later when we knew who they were. Do you support Osama bin Laden? And here in Britain, 15% on this side, the radical side, said, yes, we do support Al-Qaeda. 70% said were nominal. They did not really understand Al-Qaeda. They didn't know what they were about. They were troubled by what they had seen on the television screen. And the last 15% were what we would call liberal Muslims. So in three categories is what the survey found. That was in 2001. A year later, in 2002, they did a similar survey. And they asked the same question. Do you support Al-Qaeda? Do you support this radical agenda? This group that had been 15% here in Britain had grown to 25%. Jumped 10% in just 1 year. All taken from this middle group, this nominal group. They didn't do any surveys after that until 2006. 5 years later. 5 years later, they asked the question, do you support Al-Qaeda? Do you support this radical agenda? Do you support Islamic law? And do you, well, that was the major questions. And that the result of that survey on this side over here, this group that had, was only 15%, that had grown to 25%, now was 43% of all Muslims here in Britain now supported the radical agenda in just 5 years. All taken from the middle group. The liberals were still 15%. So that was in 2006. We're now in 2019. They have not done any survey since 2006. I would like to know what has happened in the last 13 years. But see, those are the people that I have to work with. These are the radicals that I have to engage with. These are the ones that I've dedicated my life to. And these are the most exciting people on earth because they are so passionate. Because they have a passion I'm jealous of. And they know who their God is. They know what their scriptures say. They know who their prophet is and who they are to follow. And they say so openly, brazenly, aggressively, and I'm looking at them and I'm saying, why don't we do the same? What has happened to us? Where has our radicalism gone? See, look at the word radical. What does it mean? A radical number is what? A root number. So radical means going back to the root. Am I correct? Therefore, if you're a radical, you go back to the root. And what is the root of Islam? Well, it's this book right here. This is the root of Islam. So a radical Muslim comes back to this book. Am I correct? And that's what a true radical would be. Now, we give them other names. We give them extremists. We call them fundamentalists. Extremists because from our viewpoint, from our Western viewpoint, they are extreme. Without thinking, where do you think that extremity, those extremes come from? And if you ask any radical Muslim, they'll say very quickly where it comes from. They quote this book right here. They quote it verse after verse after verse. Like that Sheikh Omar Bakri Muhammad did when I debated him on the Khilafah there in 1999. He just quoted verse after verse. Chapter 33, verse 59, cover the women up. Chapter 4, verse 34, beat the women if they disobey. Chapter 5, verse 38, cut off the hands of the thieves. Chapter 24, verse 2, beat the homosexuals 100 lashes and same with the adulterers. So verse after verse, well, that's their paradigm, that's their model, but their paradigm would be Muhammad himself. And this was introduced by a man named Ibn Taymiyyah in the 1300s. And in the 1300s, Ibn Taymiyyah, considered to be one of the greatest scholars in Islam, stipulated that to be a good Muslim, referring to chapter 5, verse 111 in the Quran, there's the definition of a good Muslim, just read it. For he is a good Muslim, follows the Quran, and obeys Muhammad. So to be a good Muslim, read the book, and follow the man, the book of the man, the book of the man. That's my phrase, by the way. I made that up. So Islam, by definition, is defined by one book modeled by one man. 200 years later in Germany, another man named Martin Luther said much the same thing, did he not? To be a good Christian, he said, sola scriptura, only follow one book. Sola scriptura, this book, the bigger book. Can you see which is bigger? I keep it bigger for a reason. So you all know which is the bigger, the better book. This is it. Follow this book, sola scriptura, and only this book, modeled by another man, a bigger man. And what's his name? Jesus. So here you have two different scholars, two different reformers. People are saying, when is Islam going to be reformed? I said it got reformed way back in 1300 AD. Because in 1300 AD, Ibn Taymiyyah stipulated that to be a good Muslim, you must read the Quran, you must follow Muhammad. 200 years later, the Protestants finally came on board with Martin Luther, and we said the same thing. And we go back to the 1500s to talk about our Reformation. Let's jump now to the 1700s. In the 1700s in Arabia, there were two men who were studying in Arabia. One was Ibn al-Wahhab, Muhammad Ibn al-Wahhab, who is an Arabian himself. He was studying in Medina, the city where Muhammad supposedly lived when he died. And with him was another man named Al-Wahihua, who is not from Arabia. He was from India. He was from Bihar, where my parents used to work, where my dad was born, and where my grandfather's grave is. He was there in Medina studying Ibn Taymiyyah's material. So he was studying Ibn Taymiyyah there in the 1700s with Al-Wahhab. The two of them graduated. Al-Wahhab stayed there in Arabia. Wahihullah went back to India. Al-Wahhab then amalgamated himself with the Ibn Saud family, who then became the power brokers for all of the Arabian Peninsula. They eradicated all the other tribes that stood in their way. They controlled the entire Arabian Peninsula, but they did not have any theological legitimacy. They only had political power. They needed religious legitimacy, and that's why they brought Wahhab on board. So with Wahhab there, giving them the foundation, the theological foundation, bringing the mosque and state together, then they created what is now today known as Saudi Arabia, named after the Ibn Saud family. And Wahhabism was formed. So Wahhabism was formed in the 1700s, all based on Ibn Taymiyyah's teachings from the 1300s. Are you following where I'm going with this? So this is nothing new. This has been around, well, we're talking about 700 years. Meanwhile, Wahihullah went back to India, and there in India, he had his disciples, he has his madrasas, and they started growing. When the British came, when you all came to India, you found many of his disciples, and they were very radical, and you confronted them, and you drove them from Bihar right across North India, right over into the western side, over in what is today Pakistan, up into the mountainous area of Waziristan, places like that, in Afghanistan. And that's where they are today. And these are all disciples who have all been trained up on Ibn Wahihullah's material, all coming from Ibn Taymiyyah from the 1300s. Let's jump to the 20th century. In the last century, 20th century, in India, two men are probably the two that I'll pinpoint because they're probably the most important. One was named Ibn Maududi, who came from Deoband, which is just south of where I grew up. I grew up in the mountains, very far in the north, up in the Himalaya Mountains, and we would go down to visit our parents in Delhi, the capital city, and we would stop at this place called Deoband, and there'd be madrasas on either side of the railway tracks, and I used to see this very radicalism. Do you remember that? I want to call you Nora, but you're not. Rona, remember that? Yeah. Deoband, Deoband were on either side, and that was where Maududi started his madrasas, all based on Ibn Wahihullah's material, coming from Ibn Taymiyyah's material. That was in the 20th century. 1947 then, India got its independence, and he then took him and all his disciples, then decided to go to Pakistan, and there he started the Jamaat-e-Islami. The Jamaat-e-Islami is one of the largest, most radical groups in Pakistan today. Also in the 20th century, in the 1920s, a man named Muhammad Ilyas in Delhi created a whole other group called the Tablighi Jamaat. The Tablighi Jamaat started there in Delhi, then started growing and moving and started shaping itself, and they wanted to bring Muslims back to this idea of going back to the Quran, modeled by Muhammad, the Book of the Man, all coming from Ibn Taymiyyah. Now, the Tablighi Jamaat has grown and grown and grown. It's in 120 countries today. It has a membership of 80 million. That's the population of Britain right there. How many of you have heard of the Tablighi Jamaat? Not one of you. Rona, you have. Just the name. The four men that blew themselves up in London were all part of the Tablighi Jamaat. Almost half of all the ones who have blown themselves up or driven across those bridges and Westminster, all of them are coming from the Tablighi Jamaat, and yet you've never heard this name. There are seminaries in Dewsbury. You've never heard of these people. Where have you been? This is your country. There's hundreds of thousands of them here, and yet they are all based on one paradigm. Read the book, Follow the Man. Go to Dewsbury and go on a Friday afternoon and see what happens after the mosque leaves out. There is a great video up online. You can go and see it. It's this guy is on his motorcycle and he's just putting through, going through the streets. And there's just hundreds and hundreds and thousands of young men all dressed in white with little topies, little beards. They're all coming out of the mosque. And you would never know you're in England. You never know you're in England. You don't see any white face at all. For 10 minutes, just solid humanity, all men and some women, but mostly men. And yet, this is your country. It's happening right in your midst, and you're still not paying attention to it. And for 25 years, I've tried to wake people up about what's happening here. I've had to deal with these guys because I'm the one that has to engage them. I'm the one that was debating them. I was the only debater for the 1990s. Only I debated them after university after university after university. No one else debated them. And I got hit. I got struck. I got knocked to pieces. I got my glasses broken. You can see where they try to open up my throat. I got vilified by the church. People said, this is not important, Jay. The radicals, they're not really that important. They only represent 1%. And I said, you people have got to wake up. Because if you don't wake up, they're going to take over. And they're not going to take over necessarily by vote. They're going to take over by biological growth. They have the bigger families. And remember, they don't choose Islam. It chooses them. You're the only country in Europe. In fact, you're the only Western country I know where there is not one law that impedes Muslims. Did you know that? You have no law against Islam here. You're the only country that that's the case. You're the first country, the first Western country that has now opened up and has allowed Islamic courts. You now have Islamic courts in this country since 2009. No other country has allowed that as part of British law. You're walking right into a trap. You have no idea of who's around you or what their agenda is or what this book says. And that's why we've been trying to get the British awake. Even in France, you have a lot of restrictions against your Muslims, but not here in Britain, no restrictions whatsoever. We cannot do open airs anymore in any city. We used to do open airs and we used to confront Islam, and the police now have moved us on. The only place I'm allowed to actually criticize Islam is at Speaker's Corner. And that's why I'm going to be there on the 8th. And every time I come to Britain, I go right down to Speaker's Corner. But I have given up trying to confront Muslims. I'm not interested in confronting Muslims. I'm interested in confronting Islam. We have to confront Islam. Because in order to stop this religion from growing so fast, it's gone from 800 million up to 1.8 billion in just the last 38 years that we've been working with them. In order to stop this religion, you're not going to do it by confronting Muslims. You're going to have to confront the whole edifice. You're going to have to confront the whole foundation of Islam. And that's not easy to do, because in order to confront the foundation of Islam, you're going to have to understand it. You're going to have to read their book, and you're going to have to understand that man. You're going to have to go back to the book and the man, the book and the man. And yet no one wants to attack this book, and no one wants to attack that man. In fact, I don't know of any school that even reads this book. Do you know of any Bible school or any seminary or any church that reads this book so you even know what you're up against? No, if you don't know what you're up against, if you don't know who your enemy is, if you don't even know what motivates them, then how can you confront them? And so what we've decided to do is we decided to destroy this book. But not destroy it by burning it like some pastors like to do, and they get fatwas put on their head. That gets the news. That's not going to do anything. Burning a book doesn't do anything. The Muslims did that themselves. That's exactly what happened when Uthman did it. Uthman supposedly burned the Quran. No, that's not the way to do it. To confront the Quran, you're going to have to confront it historically. You're going to have to shut it down academically. You're going to have to start with the intellectuals. And that's why we're doing it that way, because the same thing happened to the Bible here in Europe. Remember in Germany, when Tübingen and the school of Tübingen and men like Wellhausen decided that they were going to confront the Bible, and they came up with the documentary hypothesis and the whole what we call redacted criticism and source criticism and literate criticism and higher and lower criticism, all these criticisms that attacked our Bible. And they did a good job, and they are asking legitimate questions. These were brilliant questions that they were asking, and it destroyed the church along with Darwinianism. Those two isms destroyed the church by 1905, decimated the church right across for Europe, and the church has never recovered. Now, we can do the same thing with Islam. The great thing about the whole thing with historical criticism and our brothers back here with Darwinianism, we have a very few who are taking on the Darwinianism, but very few. There's only two sitting back here. How many others are doing that? That's why it's great that you have the two great attacks against the church in one room or in one conference. And the other one, historical criticism, we've answered almost every question of the historical critic. Lower and higher criticism, those have been answered. Redacted criticism, that's been answered. Source criticism, that's been answered. Manuscript evidence, we have now an enormous treasure trove of manuscripts that we can look at. And that's the beauty of the Bible. The Bible can answer every one of those criticisms. The documentary hypothesis is nothing more than a theory, because we've answered it all. And I got that when I was in seminary. And that's the beauty of my Bible. And that's why I love, everywhere I go, I only take two books. These two books, that's all I need. The bigger and the better book over here. The smaller and the less better over here. But no one's really taken on this book. That's over 100 years ago they were taking on the Bible. So we're taking the same criticisms, redacted criticism, source criticism, historical criticism. Next week I'm going to do 12 challenges to the Quran at Kensington Temple. They're going to film it, so it'll be up online. You'll be able to see it on my Fander Film site. 12 criticisms. Three of them will be brand new. These are the criticisms we need to apply. And every one of the criticisms I'm going to apply to the Quran have already been applied to our Bible. Now, I'm not going to take time to do a comparative because I don't have the time enough to do that. That will do on the internet. We can destroy this book right now. And every one of the criticisms I'm going to be using next week, not one of them is a Christian polemic. Not one of them is me, a Christian, saying it. Every tool that I'm going to be using will be coming from redacted criticism, which is neutral, source criticism, which is neutral. I'm going to be looking at quotations from the earliest authors. I'm going to be actually looking at the own Muslim. I'm going to take their own material. I'm going to go to all the scholars, the Islamic scholars, not all, the majority of the major scholars in the Quranic world, and look and see what they said in the 7th, 8th, and 9th century, and I'm going to compare with what the scholars are saying today. None of this is a Christian polemic. This is a historical polemic, which is as neutral as you can get, which means there's nothing, there's no, it's as politically correct as you can get as well. Not that that's my agenda. But can you see how devastating this is going to be to Islam? 3 years ago, we introduced for the first time 26 different Arabic Qurans at Speaker's Corner. 26 that we had found around the world, all in Arabic, none of them are translations. These are original Arabic Qurans, and we have found 93,000 differences between them. 93,000 differences, Arabic words, phrases that are completely different. And every one of these 26 that we introduce were all created in the 9th and 10th century. Not one of them is from the 7th century. And they're all, you can buy them in marketplaces today. We found them in marketplaces in Morocco, in Jordan, and also in Libya. Sorry, Yemen, not Libya, Yemen. So these are available. These are not something that's hidden. This is not something that's unknown. This is not something that's new that I'm introducing. The Arab scholars know this, but they don't want the rest of the world to know it. So we took it to Speaker's Corner, and we almost didn't leave the corner. You go up on Fander Film and see what happened. They tried to rip them out of our hands. They tried to take them. They wouldn't let us leave the corner with them. They had never heard this before. They finally gave up, and they just made all the Muslims leave so they couldn't hear what we were saying. But everything's on film. You just put it up on the internet that very night. Were you there, David, when that happened?
I was there that time, yeah.
We did it three times now, so maybe one of those you were there. Yeah. Now we're up to 32 Qurans, and we have another five to go. But that's not even the most devastating material. The most devastating material is what we introduced in May of this year. We have looked now and gone back to the earliest manuscript. I said a little bit about this last night, and that's what we're going to introduce again. But we have not asked Muslims where their Quran comes from, where the earliest manuscript is, and what they now know about the earliest fragments. Those we're going to introduce in 2 weeks. That's what I'm going to introduce now on the 8th. And folks, Muslims don't have an answer for this. How can you answer it? How can you answer it when you have no Quran at all that even exists until 705? Muhammad died in 632. And that Quran has a palimpsest, so it has two different layers, and the lower layer doesn't agree with the upper layer. Ooh, I love that. Because we put it under ultraviolet light, so we can see both layers. What's more, neither of the two layers agree with the Quran we have today. This one I have in my hands. So this is the kind of material that we're now going to force Muslims to not only pay attention to, but start the disillusionment. We're getting hundreds of Muslims that are leaving Islam because of this material. We have one girl, Hatun Tash, who's now been in about 400 mosques around the London area. She's a Turk. She's not even an Arab speaker. And she takes Arabic Qurans, these Arabic Qurans with her from mosque to mosque to mosque. And she just shows them to the imams. She shows them to the people. They throw her out. She comes back again. They throw her out. She comes back the third time. They finally accept her. And then she says, we're going to look at your Quran. We're going to look at all these mistakes. And then we're going to look at the Bible. And we're going to do a comparative. She does this all in English. She has been beaten up. She has almost been killed three times. And yet she's at Speaker's Corner every Sunday. You'll see her again. This Sunday she'll be there. She'll be there that Sunday. We'll be on the ladder together. I trained her up for 3 years. She is the most valiant fighter I've ever found. She is a Saul who is a Paul, or a Pauline. But this is the kind of people we need. But she's not English. She doesn't even speak your language very well. And yet she's the only one that's doing this here in England. No one else is daring to do what she does. She's the only one that goes into mosque after mosque, uninvited, all alone. She's asked Christians to go with her. No one will go with her because they're scared to death. There is such a fear in this country. She used to be a Muslim. Her father is a well-known imam, so she will be killed if she goes back. They've tried to kill her here. Two of her brothers were both killed, shot one in the head, and the other was run over in 1 week because they wouldn't kill her. From what stuff do we get this kind of woman? Where do they build women like this? She loves Jesus Christ. She will only talk about Jesus Christ. She doesn't talk about being beat up. She's never mentioned that to the press. Only the police know this. She doesn't talk about anything but about Jesus Christ. She is so driven for Jesus Christ. She only sleeps 4 nights a week. The rest of the time, she's just studying. And it's a privilege to be able to work with her. I am honored to work with a woman like this. But she's not English. She's Turkish. Broken English. And yet she is modeling for us exactly what I see in Paul. And what I see in the early church, but I don't see today. And I'm asking for you British people to wake up. You've got a growing threat all around you. And you're walking right into it. After the 31st of October, maybe you'll have more control over your borders, I don't know. But certainly, I hope the church starts to realize its responsibility, because you are the only ones that can stop Islam. Because you're the only ones that understand them. Because you start from the same paradigm. You have a book modeled by a man. The last week I was down at Speaker's Corner when I left in 2017, the last person to see me was an atheist. As I was walking away from the corner, he stopped me. He says, "Please don't leave, Mr. Smith." I said, "Why not?" He says, "Because your material, this new material that you're introducing, this historical critique, this material on Muhammad especially, this is amazing. This is finally, you're speaking our language." I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, all the Christians who ever come to Speaker's Corner, all they want to talk is about their testimony. And we don't care diddly squat about their testimony, because it's not our testimony. That's only for them. It's very subjective. You're the first one that's actually answering the questions we're asking. And the question we're asking is a much more simple question, a much more foundational question. Is it true?" That's what we're asking. Can you prove that this man died at that place at that time? Can you prove he did these things at that place? Can you prove any of the Bible is true? And you're doing exactly that, using historical criticism. And I looked at him and I said, "I'm glad you like it." And I said, "But please don't use it. This is not for you." I said, "What's the purpose of destroying Islam? What's the purpose of destroying the Quran? What's the purpose of destroying Muhammad if you have nothing to replace it with? You have nothing to give them. And I do not want you to destroy their faith. These men and women have a beautiful faith. I love them for their faith. I used to hate them. Now I love them. Because they have such a passion for their God. They have such a passion for their scriptures. They have such a passion for their prophet that we don't. And certainly you don't have any passion for anything other than just destroying. You've been just trying to destroy us. Now you're just trying to destroy the Muslims. What are you giving them to replace what you've destroyed?" He just looked at me. He had no idea what I was talking about. But we do. You know what I'm talking about. What you've been learning this weekend, this is amazing stuff. What Johnny's been preaching you, what you've been hearing from the two lads in the back, just terrific stuff, Joe and John. Amazing stuff what you're hearing. But are you going to keep it to yourself? Is this just for conferences in the middle of the moors? Or is it for the people who you're working with? Is it the schools, the students that you're studying with? Is it those, the people that need to hear this? Please don't get fat with this material. This is not for you. As Johnny said, you need to take this to the world. You've got a responsibility for what you've heard. The battle we're fighting is not in the principality. It is in the principalities of powers. But folks, the battle we're fighting is right in front of you. It's the neighbor down the road. It's the person that you're in school with. It's the ones that you come in contact with. You see them in the hijabs. You see them, yes, with their topis. Do you talk to them? Do you engage with them? Do you introduce the gospel to them? Or do you just make friends with them? See, you're being taught only one thing in one paradigm here in this country, and that is friendship first, or the grace method. That's all you're being taught. And I'd love to know where and who came up with that idea, because I can't find it in the Bible. I don't know anywhere where Christ made friends before he preached the gospel. I don't know anywhere where the disciples made friends before they preached the gospel. They just preached the gospel. When Paul, look at Laodicea, Cappadocia, Berea, there in Ephesus, every city he went into, there in the book of Acts, he went right into the synagogue. He did not make friends with anybody. He went right up to the Pharisees and he confronted them with what they had done to the Messiah. Oh, they got upset. They threw him out. Sometimes they threw him into prison. He was beaten. He was flogged. Twice he was almost stoned to death, and he caused a riot in Ephesus. They finally killed him in Rome. You don't get beaten up. You don't cause riots By making friends, folks. You can make friends any day of the week, and I would suggest the Muslims are better at making friends than you are. Because they're a lot more social than you are. It's easy to make friends. It's hard to speak the truth. And to speak the truth means you're going to have to talk about what you believe. And when you open up your mouth, you are going to confront a Muslim. Anytime you open up your mouth and say that God entered time and space, that is confronting a Muslim. That will confront every Muslim. Anytime you say that God died on the cross and rose again, that is highly confrontational to any Muslim. Anytime you say that God has a son, that will confront a Muslim. But you've got to say it because that's the gospel. And please don't leave your Muslim friend without saying something about Jesus Christ. Not Isa, as you saw before, Yeshua. Because it is Jesus, Yeshua, who is the Son of God, who is God on earth, who did, yes, die on the cross. And thank God, Friday's here, but Sunday's a coming. He rose again on Sunday. What a message we have. What little time we have to speak it, to say it. Now, I was going to go through about 20 frequently asked questions and answer them, but I changed my message because I really felt that you need to hear this. It's important that you hear this part of it. As far as the questions and answers, I have them all here, and I've been putting them out on Fander Film. I've been putting out every 3 days the most often asked questions and how to answer them. Ronan, you've seen them, and I know you have, David. They're up there on Fander Films. Go pull them down. They're about 10 to 15 minutes long, 5 to 10 minutes long, but I do have them also written up. And if any of you do want them, come to me afterwards. Give me your USB drive, and I'll give you all of these. You can have them in PDF form. In fact, I'll give you a lot of material that I haven't even given this week, and I'll just give it to you because I want to make sure you do have the material so you are equipped with it. What we're finding is almost all the questions gear around two subjects, and I said it last day, and I'll repeat it again today. The two subjects always zero in on the person of Jesus Christ. You're going to have to answer questions about Jesus Christ. Please don't run away from it. But what better person to talk about anyways than Jesus Christ? What better subject to defend than him? And what better man to use as your paradigm than the Son of God? So engage them. They're going to first. One of the first questions will be the Trinity. We went through the Trinity yesterday, so I won't repeat that one. But another one that comes up all the time concerns who Jesus was as far as his... As far as what they call the inferiority, or let's start with sonship, because there is a real problem in the Muslim's mind that if God had a son, this must be a biological son. And so they assume that when we're talking about Jesus as Son of God, that therefore God impregnated Mary, and then from her, their progeny, came Jesus. And that's why in chapter 5, verse 116 of the Quran, you have that mistake there. When they attack God the Son, they're not just attacking his sonship, they're attacking his divinity. And there are five references that I'm going to give you right now in the Quran that you need to be aware of. These are the five references they always go to. The first one is chapter 4, verse 171. In chapter 4, verse 171, it says, "Say not three, for God is one and he has no son." So who's that attacking? Three would be the Trinity. One would be the fact that he's not monotheistic and he has no son. So here they're attacking the Jesus' divinity, they're attacking the Trinity, and they're attacking Jesus' sonship. All three in one verse. Interestingly, that's the first verse that has ever been written for the Quran found on the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. The earliest inscription of any that we can find for the Quran is on the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. Did you know that? We can't find anything earlier than 691. When the Dome of the Rock was built. And that verse is there. So the whole reason the Dome of the Rock was built was to attack Jesus Christ. Look and see where the building is. It's right there in Jerusalem. Look and see. It's up on the highest point, looking down on the Church of the Sepulcher. The Church of the Sepulcher was a sanctuary for the Byzantine Christians where they would come to do their pilgrimage. So here, Abdul-Malik, who is way up in Damascus, even further north, he's not anywhere near Mecca, he's nowhere near Medina, he's nowhere near the Hijaz, he's way up in Damascus, and he plants this huge, big edifice right there in the Jerusalem, looking down on the Church of Sepulcher, and it's facing Petra, it's not facing Mecca. Ooh, I love that. The entire citadel is still facing Petra. They can't destroy it and rebuild it again. The Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is on the southeast corner, is also facing Petra in Jordan. 600 miles further north than Mecca. Puts that building there to basically to say, this is the new religion. We're the new, now we are the new people of the book. See, the people of the book, the Jews and the Christians, always had Jerusalem as their headquarters, as their sanctuary. That's why the Church of the Sepulchre was there and is still there today, down in the valley. He puts it above that, and he looks down onto it, facing Petra, and then he writes these inscriptions on the inner ambulatories, the two inner ambulatories, the only part of the Dome of the Rock that still exists today that's original. The building has been destroyed and rebuilt 11 times. That's the only original part. And there is chapter 4, verse 171. Say not three, for God is one, and he has no prophet. And then it has, for God is, did he not, he does not beget, nor is he begotten. Who's that attacking? Jesus, the begotten Son. Again, John 3:16. So it's attacking Jesus again. And then in chapter 1:12 is also included on those inscriptions. It talks about his begetting, and he begetteth not. And then it says, for truly, there is only one God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. The Shahada is introduced on the Dome of the Rock. The first time we see the Shahada anywhere in the world is on the Dome of the Rock in 691. How many of you knew that before just now? Did you know there is no reference to Muhammad in any Arab sources before 691, before the Dome of the Rock? Did you know there is no reference to any people called Muslims or any religion called Islam before 692? Did you know there's no reference to any book called the Quran until 705? And did you know there's no reference to any city called Mecca until 741? Ooh, How many of you have heard this before? You have, David. You have, because you've studied this. These are all new things that Muslims have never, ever answered. And everything I'm teaching you, telling you, has only come out in the last 10 years. This is all just coming out to now because we're, for the first time, we're applying historical criticism. And it's not me that's doing this work. None of us who are Christians who are doing this work. These are all some of the best scholars in the world today. Dr. Patricia Corona is one of them from Denmark. Dr. Patricia Corona got her doctorate at School of Oriental African Studies in London, was head of department at Oxford University when she came across this material, when she found out about Mecca, when she realized that none of these references existed. Now, she could find it better than anybody else because she reads and writes 15 languages, all archaic languages. How many of you can read and write 15 archaic languages? None of them exist today. That's why she's formidable. That's why she's the head of her department. And she was the head of department until she wrote a book called Meccan Trade and the Rise of Islam in 1987. Blew open this whole material. The Muslims were so angry they put a fatwa on her head. She had to leave Oxford University. She had to move to Cambridge University. There she was head of department when I got to know her and I became one of her scholars. I was under her tutelage and I was one of her when I started my doctoral thesis. And she was the one that actually helped me do my first debate. The 10 challenges that I gave in 1995 to Jamal Badawi, Dr. Jamal Badawi, the leading world authority on the Quran at that time, there at Cambridge University in August of 1995, those 10 challenges all came from Dr. Patricia Corona. They are still today, not one of them has been answered. And we're now in 2019. Amazing stuff. So there you have it in chapter 4, verse 171. But then you have in chapter 5, when you go to chapter 5, you go to chapter 5, verse 17, that God cannot be the Messiah. That's attacking the idea that God, that Jesus, he's known as the Messiah in the Quran 11 times. Al-Masihu, 11 times he's referred to as Messiah. God cannot be the Messiah, therefore Jesus cannot be God. That's in verse 17. In verse 72, it says that God has no partner. Well, who would be the partner of God? That would be a mushrik. Well, then, of course, that, of course, has to do with the Christians. They believe that we have elevated Jesus to the partnership of God. That's attacking him in verse 72. In 75, verse 75, three verses later, that's chapter 5, verse 75, you have the reference that Jesus and Mary ate, but God cannot eat. Therefore, how could Jesus be God? Because he ate. And then chapter 5, verse 116, as I said earlier, God is asking Jesus or Isa, is it true that you and your mother are to be worshipped as gods, suggesting that Mary, God, and Jesus were part of the Trinity? Is that a Trinity you recognize? No, it isn't. And then you end with chapter 6, verse 101. God has no consort. God has no wife. Then what in the world is God there? Are they calling God Allah, who has a consort? Her name is Alat, Aluza, the Nabataean goddess. Not only do they have the wrong God, they have the wrong name. They also have a polytheistic God. Thank God we don't have that problem. I'm getting a lot of gods in there, aren't I? So here you have these references. Chapter 4, 171, chapter 5, verse 17, chapter 5, verse 72, chapter 5, verse 75, chapter 5, verse 116, and chapter 6, verse 101. I said 5, now there are 6. I'll add another one by the time I finish. So these are the primary six references that the Muslims are attacking against Jesus Christ. And you will get it in almost all your conversations. How are you going to answer every one of those six? Well, stop and think and ask yourself a question. Do any of those six represent our Lord Jesus Christ? Not one. Whoever wrote the Quran did not read the Bible. Whoever wrote the Quran never talked to a Christian first. Because in every case, do we believe that Jesus has a consort? Absolutely not. God has no consort. Do we believe that Mary's part of the Trinity? Throw that one out. If God cannot eat, then I'd like to know what kind of God he is. And I'd like to know if the Muslims believe that God cannot eat, then who was Abraham eating with there in front of the tent of Mamre? Ask the Muslims to ask Abraham that. Well, they can't. Just go back and see who Abraham was eating with. He was eating with God. So certainly in 1900 BC, God could eat. Did he forget to eat after that? If God has a partner, then I don't even know what God I'm talking about, because my God has no partner. So where did that come from? If anything, I would say Allah has a partner. Her name's Alat. That's got a bigger problem for them. And this idea that the Trinity and the God is not three and he has no son. If he has no son, then I'd like to know, why is it that even in chapter 39, verse 4, it says that if God so had willed, he could have a son. Even the Quran admits that God could have a son. So I would actually ask Muslims, throw that right back on their lap and say, if that is the case, how does Allah have a son? Tell me, how does Allah have a biological son? See, they're on the hot seat. And I do that all the time with Muslims. You say, my God can't have a son, but my God never had a son, as you think so. Because even in Arabic, there are two different words for son. One is Walid and the other is Ibn. Ibn means relational. Walid means biological. And always, Jesus is always the Ibn Allah, Ibn Allah, Ibn Allah. He is always the related to God as a son. Which means he inherits everything the Father inherits. And if the Father is divine, then he inherits his divinity. Now, what that means is whenever you read that in the New Testament, whenever Jesus referred to himself, and he does 25 times as the Son of God, he basically says, I am God. It's a divine claim. It's as divine claim as you can get. Now see how the Muslims start to squirm. They do not like, then they get even angrier. I said, finally you get it. This has nothing to do with biology. If it was biological, let me ask you, where are you from?
Derby.
From?
Derby.
Are you a son of Derby? Please say yes.
Yeah.
This is one man that doesn't like Derby. You're Ibn Derby. So you are a son of Derby. Does that mean you are born from the ground of Derby? Absolutely not. That means that you inherit everything that Derby gives you. And that's why Ibn is always delineated as different than Walid. If he was the Walid Allah, then of course he would be the biological son of God. But that doesn't exist in the Quran. There's a famous verse, chapter 2, verse 177 in the Quran, where you have a traveler who's going from one place to another. He is known as the Ibn ul-Sabili. That means the son of the road. So anybody that's traveling, as you're all going to do this afternoon, you are Ibn ul-Sabilis. You are sons of the roads or daughters of the road. That does not mean that you have a biological relationship with the road. Are you following that? So anybody that knows Arabic knows that Ibn does not mean biological. It's relational. And that's exactly what we have in the New Testament. Unfortunately, English doesn't have that. We only have one word, son, daughter. That's it. We're not as rich a language as Arabic is when it comes to relationship. So that's why you have to confront the Quran. Confront every one of these. And I see that I'm almost out of time, but I really wanted to deal with Old Testament violence. Let me deal with that one, because I know a number of you came up with that yesterday. What are we going to do with 1 Samuel chapter 15? Verse 2-5. And what are you going to do with Joshua chapter 6, verse 20? Most Muslims will throw those two at you. They're the ones that all the Muslims know. Joshua 6, 20, God tells Joshua to go into Jericho and kill all men, women, children, all living things. That's called genocide. He does the same thing in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 2-5. Verse 2-3, actually. And when you look at that, it seems almost, how would you defend that? Well, I showed you how you can defend that as a Christian using Matthew chapter 5 yesterday. Just go right to Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, and say that we leave that in 1400 BC. We don't bring that into the 21st century because we follow Jesus now. So we're told to now love our enemies, not to destroy our enemies. But that doesn't help as far as what's happening in the Old Testament. You've still got to defend what's happening in the Old Testament. Because they will say, well, are you saying that then God confused himself? God contradicted himself? Are there two different gods, one for the old, one for the new? Is there two different paradigms? And I would say, yeah, there are two different paradigms, but not two different gods, the same God. But you need to understand 1 Samuel chapter 15 and also Joshua 6. You need to understand why God was telling him to destroy everything. And to do that, you need to go to Exodus chapter 17. Because in Exodus chapter 17, it gives the reason. And the reason is, as the children of Israel were coming out of Egypt, there were six tribes that attacked them. And it lists the six tribes. They were the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. That's all there in Exodus 17. These are the six tribes that attacked the Israelites. They didn't just attack them. They also seduced them, and they seduced them to their own gods. So God says in Exodus chapter 17 that he is going to bring down condemnation to them. In verse 14 and verse 15, all the way up into verse 17, he is going to shut them down. He's going to destroy them, and he's going to destroy their generations. So this is a fulfillment of that injunction there in Exodus 17. What's more, you need to go run through Deuteronomy 20, because Deuteronomy 20 then lays it out as to what God means. What exactly he's talking about. And what God says in Deuteronomy 20 is there are two different kinds of people that the Israelites are to confront. One are the people that are far away and those that are nearby. The ones that are nearby are those six tribes. They are the ones that seduced the Israelites coming out of captivity. But the ones that are far away have a totally different set of rules. In Deuteronomy 20, it says for those who are far away that they are first to offer them peace. If they do not accept peace, then you attack them. And you then, once you attack them, you bring them into forced labor. If you kill anybody, the only ones that can be killed are the men, not the women, not the children. So it's very clear as to what the Israelites were to do. In Deuteronomy 20, then goes on and says what you're to do with those who are nearby. And the ones that are nearby, you don't give them any recourse. You just destroy every one of them. There is no, you can ask for peace, but you don't do that. You eradicate them entirely. Why? Because of what they did to the Israelites coming out of Egypt. This was God's judgment on them. So there's two to do. Now here's what you need to ask. When Muslims bring this up, just say, listen, this is for one period, from one time, for one people, and for one place. Nowhere else in Scripture does God say we're to eradicate anybody else. The only other time that we see that God does eradicate everybody else is with Sodom and Gomorrah. But that's also in the Quran. Sodom and Gomorrah exists in the Quran. I'll give you the references. It's in Surah chapter 7, verse 84, and Surah chapter 15, verse 59. So they've got the same problem. How are they going to deal with that? And that had to do with the evilness of Sodom and Gomorrah. That was specific for that time and specific for that place. What's fascinating, when you get to Ezekiel 16, you can see that God gives and explains why is it that he had to eradicate these people that were near to them. The Perizzites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. He says very clearly it's because God had his people. God's people were his children. He clothed them, he fed them, and yet they were seduced by these surrounding tribes and taken, seduced to other gods. And that's why God said, I will then eradicate those who have seduced you. So this is a fulfillment of that promise that he did both in Exodus 17 and then he explained in Ezekiel 16. So we need to use Scripture to understand Scripture. Do that and help that. And then turn it right back on their laps and say, now let's ask the same question. I always make sure that when they ask the question to me, I ask the same question back again. So what about your prophet? What are you to do? What does your prophet do? What did your prophet do to the Jews in Medina? In 624, 625. And 627. Now, they'll need some help. So say, listen, why don't you go to al-Bukhari? Why don't you go to Sahih Muslim? Why don't you go to Ibn Hisham? Why don't you go to al-Tabari? Why don't you go to all these different traditions? In fact, Ibn Hisham, al-Tabari, those are, Ibn Hisham, al-Waqidi, those are the, what we call the Siratul Rasulullah. You go to al-Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, Ibn Dawud, those are all what we call the Hadith. And then you go to al-Tabari. You can go start with Al-Tabari, that's the tafsir. So I'm giving you three different genres, five different names for three different genres. The story is found in all of them. Muhammad lives in Mecca, right? He's not from Medina. He goes up to Medina in 622. He takes about 80 of his followers with him. So he's a guest in Medina. The Jews have been in Medina for thousands of years, or at least hundreds of years. We don't know exactly how long. But they were the natives of Medina. Muhammad was only a guest. After 2 years of being in Medina, he then creates what he calls the Treaty of Medina, which is a treaty that was set up by him and written by him. It has 21 articles, and the first article stipulates that he will be an arbiter between man and God. Now, who in the world would come to a new city, only being there 2 years, and set up a treaty that only he writes, and that he becomes the arbiter between man and God? Would you sign a treaty like that? Absolutely not. No Jew would sign a treaty like that. I would not sign a treaty like that. And yet, according to Muslims, all the Jews signed that treaty. Did they? Read the treaty. You can get it online. Just pull it down. Look at the names of the signatures. See if, let me get the names. Banu Qaynuqa's name's there. See if the Banu Nadir's name's there. See if the Banu Qurayza. Those are the three major Jewish tribes that control the commerce. They are the largest and the only Jewish tribes in Medina. Their names are not on that treaty. Ooh, Which means they refused to sign the treaty. Because they refused to sign the treaty, they did not give hegemony to Muhammad. In 624, after the Battle of Badr, which he won, he came back from the Battle of Badr with 300 men, having destroyed 1,000 Meccans, and he blamed the Jews for doing that. He then threw out the Banu Qaynuqa family because they didn't support him. In 625, after the Battle of Uhud, which he lost, he came back infuriated that the other Jews did not support him, so he threw out the Banu Nadir family. In 627, after the Battle of the Trenches, which neither side won or lost, he came back infuriated the Jews would not support him again, and he took all 800 men of the Banu Qurayza family and in one afternoon slit all their throats in groups of 10. 800 men killed in one day. All the women were taken as concubines for his men and the children as slaves. Now, I can give you five sources for everything I've just said. I've just given them to you. Muslims know these stories. So within 622, when he moved up there, by 627, within 5 years, all the Jews were eradicated. Now, I have a name for that. I call that genocide. I'd like to see any Muslim condemn that. We don't have anything like that in the Bible. God never did that. And the one time he did call them to do, to confront these Jebusites and Herod, not everybody, but only those people, and only for that time. What did the Jews done to Muhammad? What was their guilt? They refused to support him. That's it. So when that comes up, just throw it right back in their laps. But go one step further and ask the same question. I see I've run over time and I didn't need to stop there. I have about 20 others I wanted to go through. Do come get them from me. God bless you. It's been terrific being with you. Let me finish with prayer. Our Heavenly Father, it's so good to know that every question that comes down the pike, every question we're thrown with, we have an answer for. And in every question, all we need to do is look to you. Every time we're challenged, we find an answer in your example, an answer in your word. I thank you for the Bible. I thank you for your presence tonight, today. I thank you for the fact that you came 2,000 years ago and died and rose again. And because of that, we know where we're going. We know where we would like the Muslims to go as well. Lord, as we leave this place, we ask that as we meet Muslims, we engage with them, we don't walk away from them, that we not only engage with them, but Lord, that we introduce the gospel from the get-go. So that everybody that we meet will know who you are. Lord, may that be on our minds, our hearts, and our lips. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.